Hey there, I'm Mark Scarborough, and this is the podcast Walking with Dante, a podcast that is continuing to walk through Dante's masterwork comedy. We're in Purgatorio, the second canticle of comedy. We are way beyond Inferno, and now up into the first terrace of Purgatory proper on the giant mountain of Purgatory across the globe from Europe and in the southern hemisphere. If all of that seems surprising or makes no sense to you, then perhaps you need to catch up through Inferno, episodes of which lie far beyond us in this podcast. Here, we're at Purgatorio, Canto 11, lines 46 through 72. We're going to hear the words of the first penitent past the gate of Purgatory proper. He's going to tell his story somewhat. We're going to talk about why that is. After Virgil and Dante have seen some carved reliefs or intaglios in the marble, and then after they have first noticed these penitents coming along crushed by huge boulders that drive their knees up into their chests. Here we go, my English translation of Purgatorio, Canto 11, lines 46 through 72. It wasn't apparent who among them spoke these, their next words, which were a response to those from the one I follow. Nonetheless, we heard, "Sticking to the right, come with us along this embankment to find a passage that it's possible for a living man to climb. If I weren't stopped by the stone that brings my proud neck to heel and so have to keep my face turned down, I could take a gander at this guy who's still alive but also nameless. I could see if I could recognize him and force him to feel compassion for this incredible weight. I was an Italian, born to a titled Tuscan. Guglielmo Aldobrandesco was my father. I don't know if you guys ever knew his name. The ancient bloodline and the grand deeds of my forebears made me quite arrogant, so much so that I didn't think about our common mother and held all people in such great contempt that it led to my death. Everybody in Siena knows what happened, and every kid in Campagnatico knows it too. I am Umberto. Pride has made me come undone, and the same with all my kinfolk. We've been shoved into utter calamity. Because of this reason, I have to shoulder this heavy burden here among the dead until God is satisfied, since I didn't do so when I was among the living." This is a curious passage that follows on Virgil's response. If you remember, Virgil has spoken to the penitents under the rocks, and he said, hey, how do we get to the stairs that get us out of here? And we need the easiest stairs because this guy who's with me, Dante, is still in the flesh. Then they get this response. I'd like to talk about the response generally for a bit, talk about all of that, and then I want to talk about some of the technique in the passage itself and get to a larger question of whether Umberto is still guilty of pride. I'll tell you a bit about who Umberto is and his family and what we know and what we don't know about them, which is really interesting. And then finally, we're going to end with a couple questions, one for Purgatory in general and two for the developmental sequence of this canto. So let's get started. As I've already told you, this is following on Virgil's commentary, question, all that bit about get us to the easy stairs up. And if you remember, that is very decentering because we actually don't know who speaks those lines, those nine lines from the last episode of this podcast, the ones that immediately precede our passage in this episode. We don't know who speaks them, and so it's curious. And in fact, we don't really figure it out until almost the end of those nine lines. And then we come out into this, which is even more curiouser. Curiouser and curiouser, to quote Alice. It wasn't apparent who among them spoke these, their next words. And I translated this, by the way, a little roughly, these, their next words, because it's a little rough in the Florentine. It kind of skips over itself, and the syntax is a bit contorted here. There may be reasons for that that we can tease out in the interpretation, but I tried to make my translation reflect the kind of hurdy-gurdy, halting quality of the text itself. So, it wasn't apparent who among them spoke these, their next words, which were a response best of those from the one I follow. Virgil's still not named. He's still spoken of in periphrasis, the one I follow. It's not even my leader, which we get a lot. Instead, Virgil's name is left out, although Virgil is there, and we can figure it out periphrastically. But this problem leads us to the next lines, lines 49 through 51, that have a similar problem. That is, the passage goes on, nonetheless we heard, sticking to the right, come with us along this embankment to find a passage that it's possible for a living man to climb if I weren't stopped by the stone that brings my proud neck to heel, and then it goes on. Apparently, these guys are squashed so flat that it's impossible to know which guy under which stone is saying what, but also, we don't know who that us is. Is somebody speaking for the group? Or is the group speaking? That's a really big question. There aren't any quotation marks in early manuscripts. And so this question has bedeviled a lot of Dante's scholars. They want to know if lines 49 through 51, that is, come with us along this embankment, is spoken as a collective by all the guys under the boulders as they spoke that redraft of the Lord's Prayer collectively. Is this yet another collective statement? And then it comes to an end, and then one of them says, if I weren't stopped by the stone. Or does this one, who continues on with his story, does he say the whole thing, even the come along with us? It's a little bit funky, perhaps, to spend this much time talking about it, but it does bear on the passage because, and here's what I think in terms of technique, because the passage is so decentering. We talked about this last time, about how Virgil's speech is decentering, about how the poet's insertion of himself into the pilgrim's narrative is disconcerting, that insertion to tell us to pray for the penitents in purgatory, and then Virgil's bit in which we don't really know who's speaking until toward the end of it, and then we know it must be Virgil because he's talking about the guy in the flesh who's with me. And now this bit where Virgil is only spoken of periphrastically and not even with the usual term we expect, my leader. And then furthermore, who's speaking these lines and who's the us and how come we can't tell who's talking? Interesting, too, that he says this figure, Dante, is alive but nameless. You should just know there's a little translation problem there. Is it that Dante hasn't named himself or somehow is existentially without a name? Well, we kind of know it's not the last, so it must mean that this guy's not been named, but that goes back to the decentering. Everybody's decentered. Nobody really knows who's talking or what's going on. You see, the whole thing has a really weird decentering quality for the reader. This must be something about pride, about making sure the reader understands the reader is not in control, about somehow decentering the reader so the reader is, I'm going to use a really charged word, humbled in some way. Dante the poet is reaching beyond the text to interact with me, to humble me, to use that giant word. And therefore, the technique of the poetry is coming off the page and at me in ways that it might not have done through most of Inferno or Ante-Purgatory until this point. In other words, the point is to set up a reaction in me, not in the pilgrim, which may be one of the reasons that people have more and more trouble with Purgatorio and Paradiso, because it's not just the pilgrim's reaction, it's mine too, that Dante the poet is seeking. This brings us to the larger question of Umberto, and what are we to make of him? The big question that just bedevils, I love using that word in the good part of the afterlife, bedevils Dante's scholars, is whether Umberto is guilty of pride. And I think we can see that it goes back and forth in the passage. Let's look at what Umberto says. If we just look early on in his speech at lines 52 and 53, we can see that he is humbled, and so we would say no, he's not guilty of pride, because he says, if I weren't stopped by the stone that brings my proud neck to heel, and so have to keep my face turned down. Umberto is forced down and is not proud. Or if we look at line 57, we might see the humbling of this very noble fellow. He says, if I could only get out from under, I could take a look at you, and maybe I would recognize you. And then line 57, force him, the pilgrim, to feel compassion for this incredible weight. I would say that this is another moment in which Umberto is humbled in some way, because this is a very, we'll talk about this in a minute, a very long-storied family, a very noble family with lots of holdings. This is a family, and Umberto is a man, who would have been used to being kowtowed to. There would be a lot of scraping and bowing around the Aldobrandeschi. This is a very storied family who even gave members to the papacy. Landed, titled, noble. Everybody says yes to this guy and his family. So now this idea of forcing someone else to feel something for him, that never happened in his life on Earth amongst the terrestrial. Was still on Earth here at Mount Purgatory, but you know what I mean, among the life of the living on the terrestrial part of Earth. And it's so weird, because Purgatory is on Earth itself, but okay, you know what I mean, among the living. Another place where we might be able to say that he's humbled is at line 60, where he says, I don't know if you guys ever knew my dad's name, my father's name. You should just know, too, that that phrase there is in the plural you. So he is talking to both Dante and Virgil at that moment. And that bit about, hey, I don't know if you've ever known my grandfather, not grandfather is one word, but grand, my esteemed father, that seems like a moment brought low. And when he talks about his ancient bloodline, he makes reference to our common mother. You know, I didn't think about our common mother and held all people in such great contempt that led to my death. Who is the common mother? Is this a way that he's humbled? Common mother is a wild phrase, you should just know, in the medieval Florentine, and it evokes some debate, but I always think it should evoke much more debate. Singleton seems to just nail it down and say common mother is the earth. It's terra firma. So I didn't pay attention to the fact that we're all walking on the same ground, we're all made out of the same dust of the earth in Christian tradition. So given all of that, I thought myself so much better than everybody else, which is kind of the root of pride, to see yourself in more esteem than anyone else. Maybe, but there is a little bit of Eve running around behind that common mother. She just sits right behind that as the common mother of us all in the Christian notion of history. And given that, I like the Eve reference because, of course, we had Mary earlier. So we've had Eve resonating. We had Eve resonating all the way back with the intaglio where the angel said Ave. And remember, I told you Ave as an inversion of the spelling of Eva or Eve, the first created woman. Eve's been running around this stuff from the beginning. So maybe there's a little bit of Eve sitting down below this common mother too, and a way that Umberto is humbled, that he's brought into focus with his common man to realize we've all got the same mother, whether that be the earth or Eve. And a final bit toward the end, he says, I am Umberto at line 67. Pride has made me come undone. And the same with all my kinfolk. We've been shoved into utter calamity. You would say that that is a total confession of humility. This proud family has been brought very low. But then there are other bits of the speech that make us think otherwise. For example, when he says, I was an Italian born to a titled Tuscan, and the word he uses there is grand Tuscan, and then he names his father Guglielmo Aldobrandesco, as if he wants to put that name into the record. This is really, aggrandized stuff. We might look at that line and say, buddy, you still got a way to go on the terrace of pride, because you are still hanging back and hanging on to the earthly power that your family had. And when he gets down to that bit about everybody in Siena knows what happened to me and every kid in Campagnatico knows what happened to me, that again seems to say, hey, I'm a pretty big deal. You should just know, by the way, that that term I translated, kid, fante, is a little bit of a, what do I want to say, translation quibble there. Fante could mean infantryman, so every soldier in Campagnatico knows what happened to me. It can also mean a low-class man, somebody of the lower orders, in which case we would still see pride in Umberto. Or it can mean a kid, a young child, which is how I translated it, because that is the tradition of translation for centuries at this point. But the word is a little unstable in the text. So we've got examples of Umberto's pride and Umberto's humility. And in most scholarship, people want to make a big deal out of this. They get very wrapped up in saying, oh, Umberto is showing signs of pride here to indicate he's amongst the prideful, or no, he's not. He's completely humbled. My question is, why do we get hung up on this debate? Why can't it be both? Umberto is being purged of the trait of pride. It's not a sin at this point. It's a trait. And that is going to bedevil us. Oh, there's that word again. Bedevil us in the future throughout purgatory. How are these not sins? How are they not punished as in Inferno? Right now, let's just accept that there must be some way that pride here is a life trait and not a specific committed act. Ugh. It sticks in my throat just to say that right now, but let's say it. They're being purged, like Umberto, of this trait. Well, can't it be that they're not fully purged? I mean, if they were purged, they'd be off this terrace. What I'm trying to tell you is don't expect perfection in purgatory proper. Expect people to be in an ambiguous spot in which they are both proud and humbled, which is why Purgatorio is so human. Not only is it about the greatest human expression, art, but also it is about the very human problem of being caught kind of on the ropes. There's not a clear picture of Umberto here. Maybe he is both humbled and proud, and this is what he's working out through telling his story. Who is Umberto Aldobrandesco, part of this Aldobrandeschi family? He is indeed the second son of Guglielmo, who he names as his father. This is a storied family from Siena. They actually have holdings out in the Sienese Maremma, the swampy regions. For centuries, this family were staunch Ghibellines. Remember our Ghibelline-Guelph divide? We know that they were part of a Sienese political faction, maybe even pre-formation of the Ghibellines, part of the factions that fed in to the larger Ghibelline coalition. And we know they've been there since about the 1000s. So a long time by the time Dante's writing in the early 1300s. What's ironic about this is we actually don't know the details of Umberto's death. I know he says everyone knows, everybody in Siena knows, and every kid knows, but in fact, we don't know. Early chroniclers claim he was either smothered in his sleep by Ghibelline assassins, I want to talk to you about why they're Ghibelline in a minute, or he was killed on horseback in the public square of Campagnatico by Sienese soldiers. We don't actually know which of those stories is the case. We do know that this Umberto fellow held the reign of his family estates for about 5 years, that his father, Guglielmo, died in 1254 And we know this Umberto died in 1259, so he did hold the reins. His family had converted, to use a very fancy word, converted to the Guelph side, probably during the tenure of his father's rule. Sometime in there, most likely, the family became Guelphs. This was an enormous shift. The Ghibellines controlled Siena. So to make this shift is unbelievably expensive for this family. In fact, they are a named part of the piece. Well, particularly Guglielmo Aldobrandesco is a named part of the peace treaty between the Florentine Guelphs and the Ghibellines in Siena in 1254, the very treaty that will eventually set up the bloodbath of the Battle of Monteperti in 1260. You should know that commentators go wild trying to fill in details. Benvenuto, for example, claims that at one point the Aldobrandeschis held enough castles that there were more than one for every day of the year. But now, according to Benvenuto, there are none left in a kind of Ozymandias bit, you know, of a look on my work, she mighty in despair at the fallen statue, if you know the Percy Bysshe Shelley poem. There's just no evidence to support much of anything here. We can say when Umberto died, 1259, we can say his father had become a Guelph. We think his father had become a Guelph, or maybe his grandfather, but right around in there sometime, the family switched allegiances. We can say they were part of the Florentine Guelph side of the treaty between Florence and Siena in 1254, and we can say that it ultimately didn't work out well for the family, to say the least. But more we can't say. Now, let me just stop and say, does Dante know that? No, probably not. We're probably now looking at 700 years of intervening history. Dante probably sees this figure much grander, louder, and more present than we do. And unfortunately, between us and Dante, much has happened and much has faded. Sometimes I will say, I think Dante is playing with our lack of knowledge here, and he's kind of pushing us to realize how insecure our knowledge is. I don't think that's the case here, because even by Dante's day, the Aldobrandeschi would be still a kind of common parlance name. So I don't think Dante is making an ironic comment through Umberto, who thinks he's more important than he is. But I do think, as I've already pointed out to you, that we can find nodes of pride and nodes of humility throughout his speech. All right, that's all that we can say about the passage itself. Let's turn to a couple interpretive matters in the passage. One has to do with the final lines, lines 70 through 72. Umberto says, because of this reason, that is, because pride has undone the family, I have to shoulder this heavy burden here among the dead until God is satisfied, since I didn't do so when I was among the living. This is the key and the first statement we have of what's going to happen in Purgatorio. You should have done this stuff when you were alive. You should have paid penance. You should have, I don't know, walked to Campostello barefooted. You should have flagellated yourself. You should have said X number of Hail Marys or Salve Reginas. You should have done something to expiate this problem before you got here. And because you didn't, now you have to do it here. This is the overarching thematic that's going to happen to us over and over again on the terraces, and yes, there are more, of Purgatory. We do have to stop and say, okay, wait, well, so what's the difference in this and Inferno? This doesn't seem, again, that different from those gilded leaden cloaks of the hypocrites who are walking very slowly around their Malabolgia. What's the difference here? Well, of course, part of the difference is the after effect. That is, the pain there is simply, how do I say it, an annoyance, a constant problem to be in these gilded leaden cowls and cloaks, whereas here the pain has a purpose. It brings you to a state of humility that will then allow you to further ascend, well, farther ascend. Actually, it is a distance. Farther ascend Mount Purgatory ahead. So that is a difference. But on first blush, we would have to say we can't tell the difference between Purgatory and Inferno based just on the amount of pain people suffer. It's the purpose of the pain that has changed. And that's going to become increasingly a thorn in our sides as we progress up the mountain, because it's going to become more and more pressing about why these people have to suffer quite as much as they do. But at least here in Umberto's first speech, and just remember, Umberto is the first penitent we meet post-gate. We hear kind of the rationale. I didn't do it when I was alive, so I have to do it here until God is satisfied. The final control of purgation is even out of the penitent's hands. It's not just that I walk around this terrace until I feel I'm ready. It's that I have to do it until God is ready for me to leave this terrace. And a last and final question before we reread the passage. Why, I'm laughing because this is kind of a funny question. Why is the first penitent in purgatory proper so boring? This is not a very exciting figure. I mean, yes, we can tease out problems of pride and humility in the passage. We say, oh, you know, he's still got some nodes of pride, or oh, he's being humbled, and we can tease these nuances out and fight amongst ourselves. But really, honestly, this isn't a very exciting guy who's speaking to us. Certainly not on the level of Manfred, certainly not as memorable as Balakwa. Almost nobody, I shouldn't say nobody, I'm sure somebody does, but almost nobody remembers Umberto Aldobrandesco after this moment in purgatory. He's not one of those souls like La Pia, like Balakwa, that people keep coming back to. Why is the first penitent in purgatory proper so boring? And there may be actually a reason here. Dante may be setting us up for what's ahead. There is less Sturm und Drang in purgatory proper than there was even in ante-purgatory where La Pia and Balakwa were. Things are smoothing out and calming down. Dante may be signaling us with this first penitent that, hey, the game's going to change. It's not going to be as wild as it was in Inferno or even in Ante-Purgatory. These people are calmer. They're more serious. They're going about their business in a more dedicated way. So we shouldn't expect all those pyrotechnics we have had up until now. I mean, listen, Dante could have had anybody here as the first speaker in Purgatory proper. And my guess is, as a great poet, he worried about this. This came up in his head. Who should I put first? Yes, there's a class issue putting a former nobleman here. Yes, there's a way in which Dante is supporting a classism in his poetry by allowing a nobleman to speak before we get the next guy in the canto who is not a nobleman. Yes, there is a political point of seeing a nobleman brought low, but even so, you could have a much grander nobleman brought low. Think of the Montefeltros. So why this kind of low-level, slightly interesting guy first? Is it to signal us with what's ahead? Or, this is actually going to set us up for what comes next, are we actually being introduced to levels of pride? This guy's on a certain level, and then the next speaker will be on another level, and then the next speaker is going to refer to a third guy who's yet on another level. And that may be an interesting way to look at the passage and think about why this first speaker seems less, interesting, less charged than the one who comes after him. We may be dropping levels of pride as we go forward. And this is straightforward, for lack of a better word, vanilla example of pride. Let's read the passage one more time. Purgatorio, Canto 11, lines 46 through 72. I didn't say this at the opening, but if you want to see this translation, it's on my website, markscarborough.com or walkingwithdante.com. They go to the same place. You can read along there. You can print it off and make your own notes, or you can drop comments, and we can continue this conversation. But for now, I'm just going to read the passage again. It wasn't apparent who among them spoke these their next words, which were a response to those from the one I follow. Nonetheless, we heard, "Sticking to the right, come with us along this embankment to find a passage that it's possible for a living man to climb. If I weren't stopped by the stone that brings my proud neck to heel and have to keep my face turned down, I would take a gander at this guy who's still alive but also nameless. I could see if I recognize him and force him to feel compassion for this incredible weight. I was an Italian born to a titled Tuscan. Guglielmo Aldo Brandesco was my father. I don't know if you guys ever knew his name. The ancient bloodline and the grand deeds of my forebearers made me quite arrogant, so much so that I didn't think about our common mother and held all people in such great contempt that it led to my death. Everybody in Siena knows what happened, and every kid in Campagnatico knows it too. I am Umberto. Pride has made me come undone, and the same with all my kinfolk. We've been shoved into utter calamity. Because of this reason, I have to shoulder this heavy burden here among the dead until God is satisfied, since I didn't do so when I was still among the living." Thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast, Walking with Dante. Thanks for being with me on this walk. I really appreciate it that we're together here. I love this slow walk because I love being able to see the sights. This is not an if it's Tuesday, it must be Belgium trip, or if it's Tuesday, it must be the first 10 cantos of Purgatory seminar. Instead, this is a very slow walk that permits us to see fine-lined details and nuances that we would miss even in a seminar that was covering 10 cantos at a clip. You know what to do. Rate this podcast, write a review if you can in any language on whatever platform you're on. That really helps. I know that's not your problem, it's mine, but it helps out in the long run. And otherwise, we will stick around right on this terrace for the next speaker, the second speaker of Purgatory Proper, in the next episode of this podcast, Walking with Dante. I'm Mark Scarborough. I'll see you then.